I used to be clinically obese. I was obese from a pretty young age. I was always the kid who never took off their shirt. I would jump into the pool, you know, with my shirt on because I didn't want anybody to see my belly rolls and my man breasts. And then I started dieting. And for the next 30 years, my bookshelf became this graveyard of different diet books. And every diet would work for a while until it didn't. And it didn't work as soon as my beliefs about the diet changed. And that's why I would yo-yo diet for so many years. It turns out that the most important attribute of who succeeds in life, it's not intelligence, it's not luck. You know what it is?
Hello, and welcome back to the Rock Bottom Podcast. I'm Ned Fulmer. My guest today is Nir Eyal. He is an author who writes about the science of your attention, your addictions, all of the things that create your energy and the choices that you make in life. He's written both from the perspective of tech companies to how do they make their products more habit-forming, as well as from the perspective of people that want to change their own approach to their attention. Works like Hooked and Indistractable. His new book, Beyond Belief, The Science-Backed Way to Stop Limiting Yourself and Achieve Breakthrough Results, is all about our internal narratives of what we say and what we believe about the world, how changing those can change your life. I'm very excited to have you on the show, Nir. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here, Ned.
Tell me a little bit about your new book, Beyond Belief. What are the beliefs that limit us, and how might someone who's going through a hard time come out of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the book starts with one of my biggest challenges. I mean, I could go on and on. We could talk about the whole show about all my challenges, but I'll spare you most of them. But one challenge that was very difficult for me is that I used to be clinically obese. Today, I'm in the best shape of my life, but for a good chunk of my life, that was a real struggle for me. And I was obese from a pretty young age. I remember my mom took me to the doctor, and the doctor showed me this chart, and he said, "All right, buddy, that's the green normal zone. That's the yellow overweight zone. Here's you. You're in the red. You're in the obese zone." And, you know, I was a kid who I grew up in Central Florida, and we had a community pool. I was always the kid who never took off their shirt. I would jump into the pool because I didn't, you know, with my shirt on, because I didn't want anybody to see my belly rolls and my man breasts. And I just kind of accepted it for a while. And then I started dieting. And for the next 30 years, my bookshelf became this graveyard of different diet books. You know, at first I tried low fat back when we used to eat snack wells all day long. Low fat was the fad. And then somebody would tell me, actually, low fat's not the way to go. You want to be a vegetarian. That's the healthy way. Okay, so now I'd be a vegetarian. And then the pendulum would swing the other way. And then I became keto. And then I became intermittent fasting. And I was that annoying guy who at parties would tell you all about metabolic flexibility and why my diet was right and yours was wrong. And every diet would work for a while until it didn't. And it didn't work as soon as my beliefs about the diet changed. Right? Every time there was some kind of chink in the armor and I would all of a sudden be convinced that my way was wrong, I'd abandon it completely. And the weight would come back on. And that's why I would yo-yo diet for so many years. And it wasn't until I broke that limiting belief that there is one true diet. Right. And it's so many things in life we tend to approach that way, that I just need to find the right book, the right guru, the right approach, the right truth, and then I will finally be on the right path. And so what that leads us to oftentimes is information porn, right? We just get addicted almost to finding more and more and more information, thinking, okay, the right tool, the right practice, the right guru, the right approach. And meanwhile, even that becomes a limiting belief, because it turns out that the most important attribute of who succeeds in life, it's not intelligence, it's not luck. You know what it is? It's perseverance and adaptability. It's those two things, perseverance and adaptability. It's who continues. And so that was really the mind shift for me, is when I stopped looking for the one true diet and instead focused on perseverance. Because the way we get in shape is the way we do everything in life, right? If you want a good relationship, if you want a big business, if you want to write a novel, whatever it is you want to do, you want to raise great kids, you want to get in shape, you want to lose weight like I used to, you have to do it for a very, very long time. And what I thought was a very clear cause and effect. When we think about motivation is a straight line, right? I know what I want to do and I have to do it. Okay, that's how classical economics tells us incentives work, right? That if, if you pay someone, you tell them what to do, they'll do it, right? You have the behavior, what to do, and then the benefit, why you should do it. But there's obviously something missing. If it was as easy as saying, hey, here's what to do and why you should do it, we'd all have six-pack abs and be multimillionaires. It doesn't work that way, though. What's missing? What's missing is that motivation is like a triangle. Motivation is not a straight line. So one side of that triangle is the behavior, what you need to do. Okay. The other side of the triangle is the benefit, why you're doing it. The critical piece that's missing, the base of the triangle, is belief. So you have behavior, benefit, and the belief. If I don't believe that I'm going to get the benefit, maybe I don't trust you to give it to me, maybe I don't trust the methodology, that's a problem. Or much more likely, if I don't believe in myself to do the behavior, these are limiting beliefs. If I don't believe in myself to do that behavior, I'm also not going to do it. And so you need all three. You need the right beliefs in order to do the behavior, in order to get the benefit. And so the work that I've done over the past 6 years, the research that I've done, is all about how do we use the powers of belief to help us achieve what we want, no matter what that goal might be.
That's fascinating. And it seems like such a core component to who we are as humans. I mean, we're not talking about an opinion. We're talking about a belief. Like it's something very, very deep down. I imagine that also means that it's hard to shift.
It can be. Beliefs. It's important to know what beliefs are. So beliefs are not facts. So a fact is an objective truth. Okay, the world is more like a sphere than it is flat. That's a fact. Okay, that's an objective truth. The earth doesn't care what you think. That's the way it is. Mm-hmm. On the other end of the spectrum, you have what's called faith. Faith is a conviction that does not require evidence. What happens in the afterlife? God rewards the righteous. Those are faith. Those are things that do not require evidence. Beliefs are somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. Beliefs are not facts. They're not faith. Beliefs are strongly held opinions that can change based on evidence. Now, the reason this is so important is that what I realized, what changed my life, was that now without that restraint of having everything, having this need for everything to be true all the time, or I just dismissed it, now I could ask myself, not is it necessarily true? I could ask myself, is it helpful? So beliefs are tools, not truths. Beliefs are tools, not truths. Why is that so important? Because most of our decisions in life, we don't make based on facts. Who should I marry? Who should I do business with? Where should I live? What should I do today? These things aren't based on objective truths. They're based on strongly held opinions, open to new evidence. Hmm. So we can actually choose our beliefs and believe those things, even if we're not sure if they're true. And that's what I think is so revolutionary. When you think about the placebo effect, which is there's a lot in the book about pain, about persistence, about human potential. Hmm. And the reason it's so important is because, you know, when we think about the nature of motivation, motivation is only one thing. You know, we used to think that motivation was about carrots and sticks, right? Turns out motivation is actually really about pain management. That everything you do is about the desire to escape discomfort. Even wanting to feel good, right? Think about it. Lusting, hunger, desire, craving. Even the desire to feel good is itself psychologically destabilizing. So that means that everything we're talking about here, time management is pain management, weight management is pain management, money management is pain management. So if we can manage our pain, if we can manage our discomfort, we can do anything, right? We unlock our potential to persevere long enough to achieve what we want.
That's fascinating. It really, this idea of facts and pain management brings up a lot of the connections to addiction recovery where, you know, someone who is addicted to something might be not living in reality and not really seeing an objective set of facts. And then if they face rock bottom, that's kind of those consequences are the facts of reality come crashing through. And to come out of it, it seems like working on tolerating discomfort and adjusting your core beliefs are a big part of it. I'm curious what you think this idea of escaping discomfort and adjusting our core beliefs can say about the concept of addiction and rock bottom.
Absolutely. I mean, this is at the core of what causes addictions. Addictions are a maladaptive behavior that is still a desire to escape discomfort. So why does that happen? You know, people think that people get addicted to substances because they feel good. They're looking for the high. No, that's what the amateur does, right? The amateur is looking for the high. The addict is trying not to feel bad. They're escaping some kind of deeper discomfort. You know, have you heard of the Rat Park study?
The rats that are like, they'll, you know, ignore the food right next to them to continue pressing the lever that stimulates their brain type of thing.
Yes. That gives them the option of cocaine.
Our audience through it.
Yeah. So, you know, when we think about substances that are addictive, or, you know, today the conversation is around social media is addictive and this is addictive and everything's addictive these days. Mm. And we tend to blame the substance, right? The substance is addictive. But that's not the whole story. I can prove it to you. You know, we think fentanyl. Fentanyl is the most addictive substance we know. And millions of women, when they receive a C-section in the hospital, guess what they get to ease their pain? Fentanyl. Fentanyl. Hmm. How can it be? Are all these women getting addicted to heroin? Are they becoming heroin fiends on the street? Are they buying fentanyl illegally? No, because addiction isn't that simple. And a beautiful study that illustrates this is called Rat Park. So if you take rats and you put them in small little cages and you let them consume cocaine, or I can't remember what substance it was. Was it cocaine or heroin? It was some kind of highly addictive drug that they gave them. Or they gave them water. These rats got addicted. Okay, big whoop. Okay, no, that's not surprising. But then when they took these rats and they put them into what was called Rat Park, it was like a Disneyland for rats. They got to eat whatever they wanted. They could socialize. You know, rats are creatures that live in little tribes, and so they're very social animals, just as we are. They got to make babies. They got to play. They got to do all kinds of fun things. Guess what? They didn't want the cocaine anymore. They didn't want the drugs. Hmm. They didn't want the substances that we would think are highly addictive. The fact of the matter is nobody gets addicted to heroin by stepping on a needle. That's never happened in the history of addiction. We actually had a human study that was very similar with Vietnam War vets that came back from war. When they did surveys in Vietnam of these Americans who had been drafted, you know, against their will, they had to go to the war. There was something like, I think it was like a 30% rate of heroin addiction. And this was then when the DEA was started under Nixon. He believed that when these soldiers came back from war, we would have this heroin epidemic all over the country. Didn't happen. Hmm. These soldiers lost their addiction. They went back to, on average, normal rates of heroin addiction that you would see in the general population. How could that be? Aren't they addicted to these super highly addictive substances? Well, it turns out that addiction is never just about the substance. It's a confluence of three factors. It's about the person, the product, that definitely plays a role, but most importantly, the pain. The person, the product, and the pain. And it's only when you have the confluence of those three factors, the person, right, their ability to cope with discomfort, the discomfort that they're actually facing in their environment. Man, if you're in the hell of that was the Vietnam War, the same thing to do is to take some drugs, right? If you're homeless, let me tell you, I don't know if I could sleep at night without some drugs. If my only option is to be on the street, it's the rational thing to do here. So if you have a tremendous amount of stress and pain in your life, you're going to be much more likely to find an escape. And guess what? Any analgesic, anything that takes away pain is addictive to some people, right? This is why people sniff glue. Is glue addictive? Well, for some people, it can be an intoxicant because, again, it can work as something that alleviates pain. Social media, why do we keep scrolling? So, you know, are we addicted? Some people are because it's an escape from reality, and we will get addicted. Somebody will get addicted out there if they have enough pain in their life. They don't know how to deal with that pain, and there's some kind of product that will cater to that pain. Well, they're going to get addicted.
Wow. That's a wonderful...
I forgot to mention, it is not everyone. We need to be very clear. Right. Addiction is kind of this term that we like to throw around these days, that everything is addicted and everybody's addicted. I don't believe that. I think there's actually very few people, a very small percentage of the population is actually addicted. Far more people are just distracted. They're not pathologically addicted. They just like to do things that are fun.
Right. Yeah, that is an interesting distinction. And I would love to talk about some of your earlier work as well. You know, you started out kind of your first book is writing about habit forming products and kind of this tech world. you know, what caused you to shift kind of from the product and like tech world perspective to more like how everyday people can reclaim their behaviors?
Yeah. I hit rock bottom, actually. That's what happened. I was with my daughter one afternoon, and we had some daddy-daughter time, and we were just enjoying each other's company, right? I only have one child, and she's wonderful. And we had this activity book, different games that dads and daughters could play together. And I remember that one of the activities in the book, there's all kinds of little games, you know, have a paper airplane throwing contest, do a Sudoku puzzle, all kinds of little activities to have some daddy-daughter bonding time. And one of the activities in this book, Ned, was to ask each other this question. The question was, if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And I remember that question verbatim, but I can't tell you what my daughter said, because in that moment, I thought it was a good idea to just, let me just check my phone here real quick, honey. Let me just do this one thing. And by the time I looked up from my device, she was gone, because I had sent her a very clear message that whatever was on my phone was more important than she was. And she took that as a very clear signal, and she went to play with some toy outside. And if I was honest with you, Ned, I'd tell you that it wasn't just with my daughter. I would get distracted when I would say, oh, today is going to be the day I'm going to exercise, and today is going to be the day I eat right. And I didn't, and I wouldn't. Or today is going to be the day I work on that big project. You know, I'm going to finally get to work on that thing I've been procrastinating on. Nope. I would check the news. I would check YouTube. I would check email. I would do everything but the thing I said I was going to do. And so that's when I decided, you know, what I wanted, if I could have any superpower, it would be the power to be indistractable, to simply do what I said I was going to do. But when I went to buy books on how do I do that, how do I become indistractable, they all kind of said the same thing. Stop using your technology, you know, written by professors who are tenured. Thanks, idiot. Like, that's not really helpful. You know, like, I'm going to get fired. I'm not going to have a livelihood if I stop using the internet. How do you do that? I'm going to stop using email. That's dumb. And I actually tried it. I went to get a flip phone, you know, like we used to use in the 90s. And I went and got a word processor. I bought it off of eBay. Some library was throwing them out. And so I bought this like word processor with no internet connection. I thought, okay, everybody tells me, these books say that it's the technology is rotting my brain. It's all the internet's fault. It's all the social media companies' fault. Okay, I'm not going to use any of that stuff. Here I go. I'm going to get writing here. I'm going to work on my word processor. I'm just going to do what I said I was going to do. I'm going to write my next book. Here I go. But you know, there's that book on the shelf that I probably need to do some research in. Or, you know, oh, look at my desk. My desk is such a mess. I really should clean up my desk. Oh, you know what? I should take out the trash. This would be a great time to take out the trash. And so even when I didn't have the technology, I kept getting distracted. We think that distraction is new. It ain't new. Plato, 2,500 years ago, the Greek philosopher, was talking about akrasia, the tendency to do things against our better interest. 2,500 years before Facebook, 2,500 years before the iPhone. So this is not a new problem. It's part of the human condition. We constantly seek escape. And so I really wanted to get to the bottom of it. And what I discovered is that the solution is far more interesting and far more empowering than technology melts your brain.
So you found that the kind of the simple version was how to hook people, but maybe the more complicated problem is how to let people not be distracted.
The first book was about how to use technology for good. So with Hooked, I stole the secrets of Silicon Valley to build other products, right? I didn't invent these techniques. They've been, you know, I published Hooked in 2014. Right. Video game companies have been using it for decades. Las Vegas has been using it for even longer than that. Gambling is the oldest pastime, right? Cavemen were betting with rocks. This is not new stuff. What I wanted to do is to distill that psychology so that we can build better tools, right? We want to get hooked to Fitbod, gets us hooked to exercise. We want to get hooked to the language learning app that gets us hooked to, you know, helping us learn something. We want to get hooked to the financial services product that helps save us money. We want to get hooked to technology. We want to get hooked to the right technology while becoming indistractable to the wrong type of distractions.
Yeah, I see. So it's pretty synergistic in that way. I mean, that story about your daughter is devastating, and I'm sure a lot of parents can relate to that, where you are really trying to connect with your child and you feel a pull of technology in the same way. What's the solution?
what's the solution? Yeah. So the first step is realizing the difference between what is distraction. Let's understand, what does this term even mean? What do we say when we mean distraction? The best way to understand what distraction is to understand what distraction is not. What is the opposite of distraction? The opposite of distraction is not focus. Everybody says they want to be focused. That is not the opposite of distraction. The opposite of distraction, if you look at the origin of the word, is traction. Right? Think about traction and distraction. They're opposites. What is traction and distraction? Traction, by definition, is any action. Notice that both words end in the same word, action. Traction and distraction both end in action, reminding us that these things are things that we do, not things that happen to us. They are actions we take. So traction is any action that pulls you towards what you say you're going to do. Things that move you closer to your values, that help you become the kind of person you want to become. Those are acts of traction. The opposite is distraction, anything that pulls you away from what you plan to do, away from your goals, away from your values, away from becoming the kind of person you want to become. Those are acts of distraction. Now, the difference between traction and distraction is one word, and that one word is intent. Dorothy Parker said that the time you plan to waste is not wasted time. So I'm not one of these people who say, well, stop using technology. Technology is great. Technology is not the problem, folks. Of course, if you're looking for distraction, it's very easy to find. But that is not the source of the problem. If you want to watch Netflix, do it. If you want to play a video game, enjoy. Why all of a sudden, playing video games and checking social media is bad, but watching stupid golf on TV, that's somehow okay? Right? Like, why is that morally superior to watch sports on TV? Yeah, I'm going to tell you why. Because it's old. And we don't worry about things that are old. We only worry about things that are new, right? That's the definition of a moral panic. So if you want to do those things, do it. But do it according to your schedule and your values, not anybody else's, certainly not the tech companies. Conversely, distraction, so that's acts of traction. Distraction is any action that you did not plan to do. And this rears its ugly head in a way nobody expects. You think, this used to be me. I'll tell you what I used to do. I used to get into work. And I used to sit at my computer and I say, okay, now I am going to finally do what I say I'm going to do here. I'm not going to get distracted. I'm going to work on that big project. Here I go. I'm going to get started. Let me go ahead and start. And then before I do, though, you know, I should probably check some email. Right? Before I work on that big project, that thing I said I was going to do, let me just check some email first. And let me just look at LinkedIn real quick. I probably got some messages there. Let me, you know what? I should check what's happening in the news because, you know, I have to be an informed citizen. That's just part of my duty, right? I have to know what's happening here. In wars that are happening 3,000 miles away that I have nothing to do with. Let me check about it. And I kept getting distracted, even by things I thought I was supposed to do. Part of my job, I have to check email. Isn't that part of my job? Email. It's important, right? But if it's not what you said you were going to do, it's just as much of a distraction as playing video games. It's even worse because you don't even realize you're distracted. If you're playing, you know, if you're on Facebook in the middle of working hours, okay, maybe you shouldn't be doing that. But if you're checking email when you should be working on a big project, you justify it to yourself. But that is just as much of a distraction. Okay, so now we have traction and we have distraction. Now we have our triggers. What prompts us towards traction and distraction? We have two kinds of triggers. We have the external triggers. These are all the pings, the dings, the rings, everything in our outside environment. Those are the usual suspects. That's what everybody blames. But get this, Ned. There's a study that found that you only check your phone 10% of the time, 10% of the time, because of a notification, because of some kind of ping, ding, or ring. 10%.
Oh, wow.
That's so what's the shocking. Other 90%? Yeah, shocking, right? What's the other 90%? If it's not coming from your phone, where's the trigger?
It's your brain. Head. Yeah.
From your brain. Exactly. This is called an internal trigger. We have external triggers, internal triggers. What are internal triggers? Internal triggers are uncomfortable emotional states that we seek to escape. Remember how we talked about how all human motivation is spurred by a desire to escape discomfort? Boredom, loneliness, fatigue, uncertainty, anxiety. That's why you keep checking your phone. It's not the technology. 90% of the time, it's not the technology. 90% of the time, it's a feeling. And so to answer your question, the first step is to master internal triggers or they become your master. And I don't care if it's too much news, too much booze, too much football, too much Facebook. You are always going to get distracted from something unless you understand why you're getting distracted in the first place. So that's step number one, master internal triggers. Step number two, making time for traction. Can't tell you how many people, I've worked with thousands of people since Indistractable came out. And every once in a while, somebody will tell me, oh, you know what? I just get so distracted because, you know, did you see what Donald Trump just did? And my kids, they want this and my boss wants that. And I just can't stay focused. And I probably have ADHD. And then I ask them a very simple question. I said, can you tell me what you got distracted from? And they said, look at my to-do list. Look at all the things I didn't do. So that's not my question. What did you get distracted from? What did you plan to do? Don't show me your to-do list.
Mm-hmm.
Show me your calendar.
Mm.
And almost nobody keeps a calendar. They keep a to-do list, which is one of the worst things you can do for your personal productivity. To-do lists are awful, right? Most people do not know how to use a to-do list appropriately. What you have to do is to make a time box calendar where you plan out what you're going to do and when you're going to do it, including the fun stuff. You should put time in your calendar for social media. You should put time in your calendar to hang out with your friends. You should put time in your calendar to play video games. Whatever you want to do, that's fine. But you have to put it in a calendar, okay? That is the only way you can know what your values are. If you want to know what someone's values are, don't listen to what they say. Listen to how they spend their time and how they spend their money. That's your values. Mm-hmm. So put it in your calendar, just like you would budget, you know, your money. The third step is to hack back the external triggers. This is where we, you know, even though they only account for 10% of our distractions, this is where we take care of all those pings, dings, and rings. More so, we go a little deeper. That's kindergarten stuff. You know, the stupid grayscale your phone, that shit never works. That, all the life hacks and tips, none of that stuff doesn't work. It's very simple. It's only one page of my book about how to make an indistractable phone. It'll take you maybe 20 minutes max. The much more complicated, more important stuff are the emails that didn't need to be sent. The stupid meetings that you didn't need to go to that are nothing but distractions, right? Those are the much more important external triggers that you have to hack back. Finally, the last step is to prevent distraction with pacts, which is where we have a firewall against distraction. We could talk more about that, how you make these pacts, these pre-commitment devices, that if you use these four steps in concert, master internal triggers, make time for traction, hack back external triggers, prevent distraction with pacts, anybody can become indistractable.
So a pact is something that you're like having like an accountability partner with? Is that kind of the idea?
Could be. There are different kinds of pacts. We have what's called a price pact, where there's some kind of monetary disincentive. So, for example, when I wanted to finish this book, I kept delaying. It took me 5 years to write this book. You know why? Because I kept getting distracted. So finally, when I did 4 years of research, I said, okay, now I know how this works. I went back to basics. I went to first principles and learned the psychology of distraction. Okay, now I need to write the book. And so I practice what I preach. I use one of these techniques that I actually has been the most effective smoking cessation study in history. Do you know it's more effective than patches, more effective than nicotine gum, more effective than anything? The most effective smoking cessation study we have ever seen of all time is making a bet. Making a bet.
Really?
It's a highly addictive substance. Oh my God, cigarettes are so addictive. Nobody can stop smoking. Bullshit. All it takes is a bet. And people who entered that bet quit smoking much higher than any of these other treatments. So that's an example of a price pact. When I needed to get on deadline for my book, I went to my buddy Mark, and I said, Mark, I want to use this technique on myself. I'm going to make you a bet that if I don't finish my manuscript by my deadline, I'm going to pay you $10,000. Now,
that's a big bet. That's a big bet.
Do you think I paid him the $10,000? Of course not. I finished my manuscript, right? I finished the book, and I kept my money. Think about this for a minute. We will pay personal trainers and life coaches and executive coaches and trainers to get us to do the freaking things we know how to do. Who doesn't know how to go to the gym? Okay, maybe you get one private training session, you watch a couple of videos. You don't need to have somebody holding your hand at the gym, but we pay that because we want the accountability. Well, this way, I got the accountability and I kept my money because all I had to do was make a bet. So that's one example. Now, very important caveat. If you do this step first, it will backfire. You will fail. Don't listen to this podcast episode and say, oh, I'm going to make this bet with somebody. It will not work. First, you have to master those internal triggers. If you don't figure out the emotional need that you are looking for from distraction, if you don't deal with that first and have techniques in place to take out of your toolkit, it will not work. So first, master internal triggers.
So then that's more the idea of the discomfort that you're escaping from.
Right. And there's a dozen different techniques you can use. You have to have these tools ready to go so that when you feel bored, lonely, uncertain, you know what to do with that feeling as opposed to looking for distraction. So these pacts are what you do last. So what you talked about is a price pact. There's also an effort pact. There's also an identity pact. There's all kinds of different pacts you can make.
Interesting. I'm curious as to what some of those might be.
Sure.
But I think what I'm most interested in exploring is this idea of discomfort and what someone who is in a crisis moment, what's like the one small step that they might start to get out of that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure, you know, if you're in a crisis, if you're, you know, could do harm to someone or yourself, if that's a crisis moment, if that's what you mean, you need someone else to help you.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's very, very rare. But what we find is much more common are these problems that keep festering, right? Whether it's relationship problems, whether it's money problems, whether it's diet problems, whether it's ambition problems, work problems, these things that keep festering and aren't resolved. At the icky, sticky core is always some kind of limiting belief. Do you have something in mind, by the way? Is there something you want to toss out there that that maybe you're struggling with we could try and tackle? I'm not a clinician, by the way,
no,
but I did spend some time writing this
know.
Book. What's something that you keep putting on your New Year's resolution year after year that somehow doesn't happen?
Let's see. I have wanted to take a trip to Japan for about 6-7 years now, and it has not happened. So that's sort of a strange example that comes to mind.
By the way, Japan is freaking awesome. It's amazing. You should definitely go.
That's what everybody says.
So what's the limiting belief there? That's a dream of yours. It seems like it's been a dream for years and years and years, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
What's the belief around that? Why do you think it doesn't happen?
It seems like it's never the right time, or it's too expensive, or if I go with the kids, it will be too hectic. If I go without the kids, I'll be too, like, you know, like alone or kind of guilty feeling.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're doing this live. I love it. You just shared.
Yeah, I didn't prepare this.
I love it. This is great because I think people listening can now see the process. So how this is my third book, by the way. We're now transitioning away from Indistractable. This
back
is what Beyond Belief is all about.
Well, and also it's the interesting first near with your work. It seems like a lot of it is interconnected, where it's a lot about how you can change your life and like live the life that you want. And it seems like it's like here are some practical techniques, but then here are some of the deeper issues going on about your beliefs and sense of self.
That is bang on. I mean, I have a pretty awesome life now. I get to travel the world, and I've been married now for 25 years, and I have a beautiful daughter, and I knock on wood, my business is thriving. I can't complain. You know how that happened? It's because I did a lot of thinking and research, right? Research is me search. I don't write about things that I have. I know. I write about things I want to know. I was on this quest to figure out how do I solve distraction. I was on this quest to figure out why is it that despite knowing what to do, I don't do it. So the book is super vulnerable in terms of I can tell you all about the things I've changed in my life and these limiting beliefs that were keeping me back and how the liberating beliefs finally helped me, I think, live to my full potential. But yeah, that's why they all string together, because you're following my journey here. but do you want to do this for you? Do you want to explore
sure,
this?
Sure. Why not?
Okay. So this trip to Japan that you've been meaning to make for years and years and years, you just listed out several of these what I would call limiting beliefs. You know that if I go without the kids, then it's going to be too lonely. If I go with the kids, it's going to be too hectic. I don't have time. I don't have money. I don't have lots and lots of limiting beliefs. Is there one that's like most salient to you that you're like that's what I keep coming back to?
I guess the parenting guilt.
Okay, cool. So what's the belief? Can you state it for me?
Yeah, I guess the belief is if I choose to go to Japan for a week or 10 days by myself or with friends, I am somehow less of a parent because I'm not there in that time for my children.
Okay. Do you mind if I contract that a bit and say going to Japan makes me a bad parent?
Sure. That's simplifying it.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. I just want to simplify what you were saying.
Sure.
So going to Japan makes me a bad parent. Okay. So that's your belief. So step one here, everyone, we're going to identify that belief. And that was awesome. You did a great job. This can often take some time, right? This is something you may want to do on your own. figuring out what is that belief. Okay, now right now it doesn't look like a limiting belief, by the way, and that's never the case. For everyone listening, we know already before you do that it's a limiting belief, right? It's just like your face. That, you know, we all have faces. We carry them around with us all day long, but you can't look at your own face day to day. The only way you can look at your face is to look in the mirror, right? So that's what you did. So first step is identifying that belief. Terrific. Here's that belief that you're convinced that is a very good reason why I'm not going to Japan. Okay, now let's work through this. I'm going to share with you this technique that comes from an author by the name of Byron Katie. Are you familiar with Byron Katie?
No, I'm not.
No, she's great. She's an octogenarian now, but she's done some great work. And she really channeled this work that's been around for literally thousands of years, all the way back to Aristotle. It's the same process, but she codified it into these four key questions. Okay, the belief is going to Japan would make me a bad parent. First question, Ned, is it true?
No. There's so many ways that you can be a good parent in little moments, day in, day out, and it takes a lot of effort, and one, you know, singular trip to Japan is not going to change that. It's more about, you know, how you can show up in all of these little moments, like what you're saying about this moment with your daughter and looking at a phone, right? If you are able to be really present and connect in the dozens and hundreds of little moments throughout the year, 7-10-day trip to Japan is not gonna change that.
Amazing. That's fantastic. So step number one, we're going to go to step number two. We actually can skip number two. Most of the time, I can tell you about something that I did the same process too. And I usually people's first reaction, mine certainly was, yeah, it's true. Like, definitely, I can't go because of XYZ. So the second question is it absolutely true? Is it true in all cases? There's no exceptions, but you already skipped that. You already came up with an exception. Now, the third question is, who do you become when you hold that belief? So what type of person are you? How do you behave when you hold this belief that going to Japan would make you a bad parent?
I think I become someone that, like, ignores their own kind of desires for exploration in sacrifice of their family and their kids.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Sounds like maybe a bit resentful.
I guess. Yeah. It could lead to that. Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Cool. Anything else?
I guess in some ways I become someone that wishes and wants to do something, but then doesn't actually do it. You know, that like kind of doesn't like make a plan and follow through on something.
A bit unfulfilled.
Yeah.
Yeah. In this respect, not in all life, but in this respect. Okay. Terrific. Let's move on to the question.
And
four.
This is like a very simple example. I mean, I've picked a safe one for you, but this is a very interesting going through this exercise. Yeah.
You can do this. After we're done with you, I'll share one of mine in a minute here. Let's do number four. The fourth question is, who would you be without this belief? So if I had a magic wand and I could deprogram your brain to no longer believe that going to Japan makes you a bad parent, what would change? How would you be different?
I think I would feel, or I would be, I mean, I would be a good parent who also prioritizes and makes time for my own, you know, desires or sense of exploring. And then I would be a more perhaps well-rounded and interesting person and parent. I don't know. I guess I would be someone that both makes time for their children and themselves.
Okay. Terrific. Great. So here's what we've established in just like 2 minutes here.
Yeah.
You've identified that belief is not always true, that there are exceptions to that belief. You've identified that holding that belief has some negative consequences and that releasing that belief will have positive consequences. Okay. So we've already established that in just a couple of minutes. And again, you can do this I've seen this done with severe trauma. I've seen this done with abusive relationships. I've seen this done with really tough stuff that people go from this absolutely happened to me, this is absolutely awful, and then suddenly considering other options. Because the end result of this, we're not quite done yet, the end result is not to change your mind. It's not to change your mind. Nor is it to find the truth. Because again, these are beliefs. They're not facts. It's not faith. These are beliefs. And so what we're trying to do is to collect what's called a portfolio of perspectives, all of which may be true. Some of them might be false. We don't know. We're going to collect this portfolio of perspectives. So now what we're going to do is called a turnaround. And the turnaround, we're going to take what you said, going to Japan would make me a bad parent, and we're going to turn around. So what would be the opposite of that statement? The opposite would be going to Japan would not make me a good parent. Or even better, going to Japan would make me a good parent. Sounds crazy. Sounds crazy. How might that also be true? Can you think of any way that going to Japan would make me a good parent?
I don't know. I guess if I, like, you know, came back with a bunch of, like, cool Japanese stuff for them to get into and, like, influenced my children in a new, like, personal and cultural perspective, it going alone might also help me plan out a potential future trip with them, you know, once they're older, to know, like, oh, these are the good spots to go with kids, these are not. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's really hard to think of, like, what's the exact opposite and then to, like, do that.
what about a happier dad, right? You said that you're a bit resentful, so you're carrying that around every day, right? What if you came back and you were more fulfilled and you had cool stories and pictures to show them? And nobody said that the requirement was that you have to be there for years or even a month or even a week. Heck, you can hop over, spend a weekend in Tokyo and come back, right? There's lots of different options here. So here's what we did. This is the very, very shortened version. But now you have a different perspective to consider. And that's oftentimes all it takes. So can I tell you how I use this in my own life?
Yeah, please, please.
It was my mother's 74th birthday, and for her birthday, I wanted to send her some flowers. And the problem was that she was in Central Florida, where I grew up, and I was in Singapore. And that made it very difficult because I had to find the local florist. I had to make sure the flowers were delivered on time. I wanted to make sure that they were from a reputable florist and that they wouldn't wilt in the Florida heat, et cetera, et cetera. I stayed up till 1 a.m, Ned, okay, calling all these florists and figuring out who would deliver it. I found a florist. I placed the order. I went to bed at 1 a.m. I patted myself on the back. I'm a good son, right? I wake up the next day. I call my mom for her birthday. And I said, hey, happy birthday. Did you get the flowers? And she says to me, yes, I did. Thank you very much. But you should know the flowers were half dead. Don't work with that florist anymore. To which, I thank you for that expression. I appreciate your shock and awe about that expression. To which I said, I went from being a grown man to suddenly becoming a 12-year-old. And I said, well, that's the last time I buy you flowers. And that went over. Yeah, exactly. Same face you're making now. Man. And so that went over just about as well as you'd expect. After the call, my wife turned to me, and she knows me very well. And she said, honey, do you want to do the work on this? Exactly what we just did. She just said, do I want to do the work? And my first reaction, you were a great sport. My first reaction was, no, I don't want your mumbo jumbo self-help touchy-feely bullshit. I want you to tell me why my mom is too judgmental and hard to please. Like, how could she possibly say that? I just got her a present. Like, what the hell? What are you doing to me? And so I went through the four questions. Number one, is it true? First of all, I took a pause. I forgot to tell you that. I collected myself. I sat down with the pen and paper and I wrote down what was my belief. My belief was my mother is too judgmental and hard to please. Okay. First question, is it true? Hell yeah. Didn't you just hear what I told you? Like, what mother does that, right? She's clearly too judgmental and hard to please. It's true. Yes, it's true. The second question, is it absolutely true? Is there any circumstance where she wasn't being too judgmental and hard to please? I mean, maybe. I don't know. Okay. Maybe she was, I don't know. Maybe she was just trying to, you know, make sure I didn't get scammed or something. Okay, fine. Maybe there's a 1% chance that she wasn't being too judgmental. Fine. Number three, who would I be without that belief? Well, to be honest, I'd probably be more patient. I'd probably be nicer. I'd probably be my real self if I wasn't, you know, taken to 12-year-old me and say things I later regret. I'd be a better person if I didn't have that belief. And then, the third question, I mixed up the other. The third question is, who are you with that belief? I'm all the opposite of those things. I'm impatient. I'm not a very nice person. I say things I later regret. And then finally, the fourth question, who would you be without that belief? What I just said, I'd be much better. And then I did a turnaround. And here's where it really gave me a breakthrough. I turned around that belief of my mother is too hard, too judgmental and hard to please. What's the opposite? My mother is not too judgmental and hard to please. Could that possibly be true? I have to accept it could be true. Maybe she wasn't being too judgmental and hard to please. Maybe she just wanted to save me a few dollars and, you know, give me my money back. Okay. It was a weird way to show affection, but I guess you could think it was, she was not maybe being judgmental. There might be a 1% chance that's true. Fine. Now, another type of turnaround. I am being too judgmental and hard to please. This is called the turnaround to the self. I am being too judgmental and hard to please. Could that be true? Is there any interpretation of what just happened that could make that true? Yeah. You know, I called her and I wished her happy birthday and I wanted her to thank me in exactly the phrasing that I expected. I wanted effusive praise for my efforts, and when she didn't deliver, I lost it. So I was being too judgmental and hard to please. Maybe not her. That can also be true. And here's a third one, the worst of all. I am being too judgmental and hard to please to myself. Ooh.
Huh.
Boy, how could that be true? Well, here's what really happened. When I sat with that for a minute, now I'm even getting goosebumps thinking about it. The truth was, I had this super high expectation of myself that when the flowers weren't delivered exactly as I wanted, it was a statement on me. When I didn't deliver to my mother's expectation, I felt like I was incompetent. So I was being too judgmental and hard to please to myself. Now, back up a minute. It doesn't matter which of these interpretations is true. They're all true. They're all false. It doesn't matter. One belief that my mother is too judgmental and hard to please locks me in a cell, because the only way I can be happy is if she changes, right? Whereas these other interpretations, now I have options. Right, back to you, that if you believe going to Japan makes me a bad parent, there's only one thing to do, not go. Done. End of conversation. You're in a prison, right? Whereas now if you have a portfolio of perspectives, you can look at them all and say, well, is there any interpretation where another belief might also be true? Because remember, beliefs aren't tools. They're true. Beliefs aren't truths. They're tools, right? It's really important to remember. Beliefs aren't truths. They're tools. And so now you can look at one of those other beliefs and start adapting it to get you what you're looking for, to achieve those goals, to have those outcomes that you're looking for. So as opposed to that limiting belief that saps motivation to get what you want, now you have a liberating belief that supplies motivation.
That's really fascinating. This turnaround idea, you know, anytime you said one of these turnarounds, it starts by sounding so crazy and so wild.
So like, crazy. Absolutely.
And then turn around on yourself and you're like, what? Okay.
The more crazy it sounds, that is a signal to go deeper. Because what all these turnarounds really reveal is not other people. It reveals you, right? The most true turnarounds, the one that at first sound the most crazy but then reveal the most truths, are the ones that tell you something about yourself, not the other person. The really deep truth is that I had very high standards for myself and I expected myself to be the perfect son all the time, right? It's a reflection of my values, not the other person. So the turnarounds that sound the most crazy are the ones you should lean into and particularly ask yourself.
Is there a potential dark side to this where when someone gets presented a menu or a buffet of potential beliefs, they then choose the one that's the most self-serving and kind of starts to, you know, continue to behave in or behave more in a way that is like not on their highest self? You know, kind of what I mean? I wonder if some people might use this exercise and then kind of use it as an excuse to do what they want.
Well, I mean, I think if it's done correctly, remember, a belief is by definition a conviction that's open to new evidence. And you're constantly looking at how you can be better and meet your full potential. So I think for me, it didn't make me more selfish. It made me actually much more compassionate to my mother. What I was doing before, and this is really gets to the heart of your question. I get this question a lot. Isn't what you're saying when you say beliefs are tools, not truths, aren't you just telling people to gaslight themselves? like to just be delusional and make up whatever beliefs you want.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm going with this, where you can have a rationalization or a delusion that you then follow and in a way that like negatively impacts yourself.
Here's the crazy part. Here's the crazy part. You're already gaslighting yourself.
Hmm.
You already live in delusions. You think you see the truth? No. You have convinced yourself of all kinds of self-serving beliefs because they served you at some point. Now they may not serve you anymore. So I'm not telling people what to think. Not at all. I don't think that anybody can tell someone what to do with their lives. What I want to give folks is what I got, which was a toolkit to now choose between those beliefs. Which one now is better than the delusion?
You're already gaslighting yourself.
You're already gaslighting
yourself. It's wild.
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. So you're saying that beliefs could already be, they could be positive, they could be negative, they could be true, they could be not true, but here is a framework for interrogating those beliefs and then presenting alternatives that hopefully make you jump out of whatever paradigm you're in to say, hey, maybe this alternative is actually more truthful. Hey, maybe this alternative is more healthy for me, or maybe this alternative is more connected to my self and sense of self and my values. That's really fascinating.
Exactly. Because you're not doing this for areas that are great, right? You're doing it for the areas where you're stuck, right? Where you have dreams, ambitions, hopes, things that you want for your life, relationships that are unrepaired, you know, that diet that you never worked, that never happened, the novel that was never written, the business that you never started, whatever it is that you know you're capable of, but for one reason or another isn't happening. You're not taking the advice you know you should. That's where you need to explore deeper. If that bugs you, because you're already have a belief. You already are self-sabotaging. You already are delusional. Now we're trying to figure out, okay, let's take a step back, have that portfolio of perspectives to figure out if we can try something else for size. And by the way, you could try on that alternative perspective and try it on for size, and it may not work. It's okay, because the other belief wasn't working either, right? The status quo also wasn't perfect. So we can try on a different perspective, try it on for a week, 30 days, doesn't matter, and then shift
just
again.
Try on a belief like it's a shirt. Just put it on like a jacket.
It's literally the glasses with which you see the world. And that's the three powers of belief. We've only talked to just scratch the surface. The three powers of belief are the power to change what you see, what you feel, and what you do. And by changing your beliefs, you know, we think that we see objective reality clearly. We do not. It is a simulation that's happening in our own brain. We don't feel things accurately. We know that the power of beliefs can literally change how you experience pain. In the book, I talk about pain reprocessing therapy, where people with fibromyalgia and chronic pain and all severe migraines cure themselves of pain without medication, without hocus pocus, without chakras and woo-woo stuff, simply through the power of changing how they anticipate their feelings of pain.
Wow.
The power to change what you do, the power of agency. These three powers of belief are, I think, as close to we have as real miracles. And with none of the woo, it's all science backed.
That's so powerful. And that resonates with me because I have MS and I've had it for over a decade now. And there was a big, you know, horrible like symptoms that I was feeling that were helped by medicine and steroids. But then after that, there was this baseline level of sensory disruption that over time, I didn't do an exercise like in your book, but I guess over the last 10 years, I've just sort of learned to ignore it. And if someone asks me, hey, are you feeling this XYZ? And I think about it, I say, oh yeah, I guess I am feeling that. But 99% of my day, I go through it, you know, grabbing items, doing athletic events, and just kind of living my life, not thinking about it, because I kind of learned to just believe that it's not affecting me.
It's first of all, congratulations. That's not easy. A lot of people, not any, through any fault of their own, a lot of people, including I used to have really bad back pain. We enter into this what's called a fear pain fear loop. That when we associate what we get wrong is that we think that pain always means damage, and that is not true. There's a difference between illness and sickness. Okay, those are not, we use those terms interchangeably. That's, they're not the same thing. Sickness is when there is physiological damage in the body. And sometimes that damage can cause pain. Not always, right? There's these stories of World War I soldiers who carry their buddy to the medic. And they say, medic, my buddy just got shot. My buddy, you need to help my buddy. And meanwhile, the medic turns to the soldier and says, soldier, you're missing an arm. So wow. Because they were so paying attention to helping their friend, they didn't notice that their arm had just been blown off. So wow. Sometimes damage does not cause pain, right? In your case, it's a perfect example. Even when you have physical damage, your brain can take those pieces of information and tune them out and ignore them. I mean, think about how humans survived for 200,000 years. They had all kinds of infections and sores and bites and all kinds of stuff. They don't have, you know, they had a million different parasites and diseases they were carrying around. They function because their brains are adapted to tune out pain. Illness, however, is different from sickness in that it's an illness is the perception, the symptomatic perception of information symptoms. And you can have illness without sickness. You can actually feel that pain even if there is no damage. This is what chronic pain is. Chronic pain that is pain that persists 6 months after there's no sign of any kind of damage. And this happens in many, many cases. Fibromyalgia is this blanket diagnosis. When we don't know what else you have fibromyalgia. Migraines, anxiety, all of these type of illnesses where we can't find any kind of physical damage. We think what it is this fear, pain, fear loop. That we think, oh my gosh, I gotta avoid pain. This is what I used to do with my back, right? Because the standard advice, your back hurts, what do you have to do? You have to ice it.
Rest it.
No, you have to heat it.
Ice it.
You have to rest it. Exactly. Don't move it. Don't do anything. Oh, you can't move it. Why can't I move it? Because you might cause more damage. It turns out that there is no correlation between who has, you know how they say, oh, maybe you have a slipped disc. By the way, if you go to the doctor and you have back pain, they're going to find a slipped disc. Right. If you're of a certain age, almost everybody has a slipped disc. Right? Like it's just a little blip on an X-ray. It's very, very common diagnosis. There's no correlation between having what is so-called slipped disc and pain. Many people who have a slipped disc feel nothing. And so what happens is this fear, pain, fear loop of, oh my God, this is going to be so bad. Actually accentuates the pain because what happens is your brain hyper-focuses. This is the power of belief. Again, the power of attention, the power to change what you see, feel, and do. To hyperfixate on that sensation, and then your body turns up the amplifier of that pain, which of course causes more pain, which just fears this pain, fear, pain loop. And so the best thing is exactly what you did. The way I got over my back pain, you know, I used to have back pain and I used to have a twinge and I said, oh, don't do that ever again. I'm so scared that I might feel pain again. Now I don't do that. You know what I do now? Every time I feel back pain, and I still eventually do, you get to a certain age, you're going to feel back pain. I do the same movement 10 times. I literally do that thing 10 times to teach my body I'm safe. I'm cool. Just a signal. Doesn't mean damage. It's just a signal. And over time, this is exactly what happens. This is what pain reprocessing therapy is all about, which is a very well-studied technique of teaching the body that pain does not mean damage, and it's oftentimes nothing to be scared of.
Wow. Well, this is fascinating, deep work that it seems can really change people's lives. I feel like I could talk about this for a whole another hour. This book is right up my alley. Beyond Belief, get it anywhere books are sold near Eyal. Thank you so much. Final question for you. What is something you would say to your younger self?
Ooh, good question. What is something I would say to my younger self? I would say it's all prom. It's all prom. What do I mean by that? You remember your prom, your high school prom? Did you go to school in the States? Okay. Where'd you grow up?
Jacksonville, Florida.
Oh, okay. I grew up in Central Florida. So proms are a big deal in Florida. And I remember when I was going to go to my prom, it was the biggest deal, right? Like, who are you going to go with? How are you going to get there? What's the after party? Like, it was a big deal. And, I kind of stressed out about it, right? Like, I'm embarrassed to admit it now, but like, everybody wants to think that their prom was super awesome and everybody had a great time. For me, it was kind of stressful.
a lot of pressure.
Right? A lot of pressure, a lot of social anxiety. And now I try to remind myself that that thing that seemed to be like such a big deal, in retrospect, now that I grew up, who cares, right? Like, it was absolutely meaningless. Like, by the time, it was such a big deal.
One party that you got a little more dressed up for.
Exactly. And now every time I go through stressful occasions, I will literally repeat that. I will repeat that little mantra. It's just prom. Mm. That at the end of the day, big picture, we're a little blue marble in this huge vacuum of space. And we're all just lucky to be here. It's just prom.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective, because if you apply that to your adult life, think, hey, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I'm going to look back on this moment that I think is so like big and overwhelming as the same perspective as my high school prom. Yeah, that's a cool one. I haven't heard that before. Very cool.
And the best thing to do is to find the joy in it, right? Find the opportunity. And life is full of opportunities. I mean, when I think about the cosmic coincidence, the incredible good fortune that we have to even be having this conversation, it blows my mind, right? Like the chances of us being here are so infinitely minuscule that the only appropriate response has to be to dissolve suffering, that we don't need to suffer. Pain is inevitable, right? That's the Buddhist mantra, that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. I truly believe that. It's how we interpret, it's how what we believe about that pain that turns it into suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a great note to end on. Nir, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Ned. Thank you.